Well, we're going to talk today about Al Bielek's life as Ed Cameron. Probably the best place to start, I would think, would be describe your parents.
My life began as Edward Cameron on the 4th of August, 1916, Bayshore, Long Island. My father was Alexander Duncan Cameron, Sr., I guess we'd call it, because I have a brother with the same name. He was born himself in 1891. And the exact date I don't recall now, but I know it was 1891. I do have his birth certificate. I did dig that out. My mother was, last name was not Cameron, it was common law marriage. His father had another one up in Boston. Connecticut.
Had another wife?
Another living common law wife in Connecticut, because he ran back and forth for the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Navy at that time. He had graduated from Loyola High School and enlisted in the Navy. His rank upon discharge in 1929, December 29, was bosun's mate, first class. He never met so far as an overmate, petty officer, chief. It was the first class rating. But he had two common law wives at that time. One, the name of Orville, that was her maiden name, was my mother. And there was another one, name unknown to me, is the one that Duncan was born of about 7 months later. Now, if you'd seen any of the pictures of my father, he was extremely good-looking in his youth, and the only problem he had with women was keeping them away. So he wound up with two common law live-ins, and then, of course, when the United States became involved in World War I, actively, he was called out to sea. And they had abandoned his two live-in wives. My mother, my natural mother, was apparently a German citizen, and she went back to Germany.
What date was that she went back?
I'm not sure. I really have no data on that, and neither do the archivists who get the family records have any idea of it. In fact, the archivists can't even find my name in the archives. As Edward Cameron, nor can they find Duncan Cameron's name in the archives either, which is somewhat strange. To me, it seems like they've been erased.
Hey, you said your mother's name was Orville?
Orville, A-R-V-I-L-L-E,
okay.
Same as my middle name. So I just used the middle initial A. She went back to Germany, to Königsberg, and lived in a castle. Apparently, family had money. And I found that out after a trip back there, but to go back into the history of myself, I and Duncan were raised by Auntie Arnold in the big house on Long Island, a 26-room mansion built with the monies of the Arnold Constable store fortune. It was started in 1905 and finished in 1906. Auntie Arnold lived in it, and she raised Duncan and myself for a number of years. And eventually we finished grade school and high school. I don't even remember which ones I went to. But finished high school 2 years early. It's not difficult to do in those days if you had any smarts at all, because there were no rules or regulations against it. Today, many schools will not allow it. In any case, finished with that, and I went to Princeton. Family had money, and of course, it's a prestige school for families of stature, if you will, and the pecking order being what it was then. And I went there in 1932 to Princeton. Duncan went off to the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. He remained there until he finished all of his work with his PhD in physics in 1939. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in 36, took a master's degree at Princeton, and during this period of time got to meet Dr. John von Neumann, who had been teaching at the school since 1930, I believe, is when he arrived there. And he became part of the Institute of Advanced Study in 1933, the time of its formal formation, that is, formally opening the doors, which they invited a number of people, and four people joined the staff initially. It was Dr. John von Neumann, Albert Einstein, Dr. Oswald Veblen, and a Dr. Alexander. The last two I know very little about.
Now, weren't you and Dr. John von Neumann very close?
Yes. We were quite close. I did not understand the reason for that for many years. In fact, long after I finished my schooling, and I should say, really, until I became albilic and started doing some digging in the archives, did I begin to understand what was going on. So John von Neumann did marry while he was in Europe, and apparently it was a short-lived marriage, approximately 2 years. All of his marriages were apparently doomed to failure because he was more married to his career and his vocation than he was to his wife. Mm-hmm. And after a while, I got a little tired of it. I can say I hardly blame them, but that was the way it was. He was a scientist first and a husband second or third. And, as far as I know, he never played around. It was just a matter of he was too busy doing his work.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out that he was felt quite close to me, and at a much later time, much later years, I had reason to believe he was my stepfather. And the reason was that his first wife in Europe, and what I was able to determine, was my natural mother. Now, how that happened, I don't know. It didn't last. You know, he left Europe in 1930. He took his PhD in mathematics in 1926, taught in the German university system until about 1930, then moved to the U.S., taught at Princeton as an adjunct professor in the graduate school, and was invited to join the staff in 1933. I still have that letter. I got a copy of it out of the files. And he joined at an unheard of salary in those days of $10,000 a year.
How did you find this connection between your...
I'm not sure where I found it now, but I found it through some of my research, and it is not something I can prove. I mean, there's no...
Right.
Solid, firm evidence that I have been able to turn up at this point.
Just a hunch.
Now, there may be evidence of this in his classified files because Princeton, or I should say the Institute of Advanced Study, has a library, a very large library of all the people that ever have worked for them, actually on staff. As they told me, we keep no files of anyone who was a consultant here or not actually on staff, paid by us. And they had huge files of von Neumann. They said most of them are still classified. Mm-hmm. This was in 1989-90 when I was back there looking around.
Mm-hmm.
So how much may still be buried in his files is a very good question.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing you did show me was there is a picture of an A. Cameron in the Princeton yearbook, which you have.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and you think the reason why it's still there is because they put an A instead of the E.
They left the Edward off.
Mm-hmm. Was that common? Do you think you were actually called Alexander?
I'm sorry, what?
Were you actually called by a different name at that time, do you think?
No, just called by the name of Edward or Ed.
Okay, so it could have been just a mistake.
Right, now why that was left off, I cannot imagine. It just happened. I noticed there were a few others in that yearbook who didn't have a first name down as such. So whether it's a printer's carelessness or whether it's just the way it was given, I do not know. I certainly wouldn't have given my name as A. Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Could have been on an application form or something. Now, at that time, as you were growing up, were you and your brother Duncan very close?
Yes, we were. We were raised largely in the big house, as we called it, 26-room mansion on Long Island. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
It was not in the form of a 26-room mansion anymore. It's been cut up into apartments, six of them. But in any case, we were raised there. And, of course, when we finished our high school and went off to college, we were no longer there. Now, in 1939, I finished my schooling. I was transferred to Harvard for my Ph.D. on Dr. von Neumann's, I could say, almost insistence. He was quite certain it would be better for me to graduate from Harvard with a Ph.D. than Princeton. Today, I wouldn't be able to come up with a good reason as to why, because Princeton, of course, is a very excellent school and has a very fine reputation. But he felt it would be better for me to take a Ph.D. at Harvard in 39. It was perhaps number one school in the U.S. at that time. MIT and I did emerged as a major school, and Princeton, while it was a major school, was perhaps in the shadow of Harvard. So I transferred to Harvard in 37 and finished up my Ph.D. work in the summer of 39.
Did you actually work with Dr. John von Neumann while you're getting your master's degree? Okay, did you actually work with him in any capacity, or... Was it just
von Neumann?
Right.
At that time, no. I saw him on a fairly regular basis in there. He was, of course, from 1933 on, working on the Philadelphia Experiment. Actually, it was not called that at that time. It was called Project Invisibility, and was only one of many far-out projects undergoing research at the Institute and their laboratories. At that time, in 33 to 39, they were still building the place. They had a old wooden ramshackle building which served as their laboratory. They had some other buildings, and they didn't finish the main library and shall we say, office building, Fold Hall, until 1939. So they were working with a lot of temporary structures and buildings in the period of 33 to 39. And Neumann, of course, was still teaching during that period of time. And I knew very little about what other work he was doing at the Institute. He never really discussed it.
Ah, so you were one of his students then?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, there was not classified work at that time at the Institute, working on Project Invisibility. It was an unclassified project. It was a pure research program. The director of the program was Nikola Tesla, so it was appointed to be director by President Roosevelt in 1933. And Neumann was a little bit annoyed about this at first, because Tesla was a man of known experience, never failed in his projects, but unfortunately for academia, he didn't have a degree to his name. And that didn't sit well with the PhDs on staff, and particularly von Neumann at that time. But von Neumann did get over it eventually.
Well, during your years at Princeton, did you ever actually get to meet Tesla?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I did. Got to meet him once or twice, because he was in and out. Up until sometime in late 39, he was only there once in a while as a visitor, because unknown to the public, when the company he'd been working for in World War, prior to World War One, which was a North American division of the Marconi Company, they were seized by the federal government at the beginning of World War One as a possible hotbed of spies and saboteurs, and the people were held in limbo. But Neumann had no connection with this. He was in Europe. But Tesla was asked by Roosevelt, who was in Undersecretary of the Navy, if he would be interested in doing some war work for the government, which he said, yes, definitely. And he worked on some communications equipment. Now, the records for this are hard to come by, but there was a system of voice communication developed by Tesla during World War One, where they could communicate by voice directly to Europe, static-free, before the time of any commercial broadcasting. And it was involved a very special antenna system, which the records have been dug up. I've forgotten the exact name of it, but the transmitting equipment was perhaps not so exotic as was the antenna, which developed a ground wave which would travel on the surface or below the surface of the ground and communicate directly to Europe. Now, whether he was using higher order like scalar transmission modes, I don't know. I've never seen any record of the system itself. That's probably buried still in Tesla's notes, which were seized by the government at the time when he allegedly died. But the antenna system did surface as it was patented, and it did surface eventually much later. It was a government-covered patent.
That sounds very familiar to me as the type of system they used to communicate with submarines.
Yeah. Well, when the war ended, they took the group of engineers who had been with Marconi, and they formed a new company called RCA. And it went online, so to speak, in the fall months of 1919. Tesla was an engineer, and then he became a principal engineer, then he became the chief engineer. And then the last 4 years he was with RCA, which is 35 to 39, he was a director of engineering and research worldwide. Now, nobody will ever find the records of Tesla and the payroll of RCA. In fact, all the records have been destroyed. Found that out some years ago. Whether it was inadvertent or deliberate, don't know. But he didn't go under the name of Tesla when he was working for the company. He used a grandson's name, or nephew, no, not grandson, sorry, nephew's name, for his name as being listed on the payroll.
Yeah, because he never married, did he?
I'm sorry?
Tesla never married, as I recall.
No, he never married. He had an interest in one woman at one time, and that was when he first came to the U.S. and happened to be the wife of the publisher of the Century magazine. Mm-hmm. He became very close to them in a professional way, to both of them. But it was known that there was a amorous feelings between the publisher's wife and Tesla, but Tesla, being the gentleman he was, never pursued it, never tried to do anything about it. And, of course, she was a woman who was in a position where she didn't do anything like that. In those days, it was almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
Today, of course, it would be very common, but
in the
1880s, things like that rarely happened.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to your meeting with him. Was it, I guess at Princeton, was it a very brief meeting?
It was very brief at first until I became involved with the project. It was brief and...
Involved with the Philadelphia experiment, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And when I got finished with the schoolwork, what happened was that father, who had retired from the Navy in December of 29, mm-hmm. but unbeknownst to us, maintained his connections with the military in terms of being a... courier is not the right name. He was in intelligence. He was an intelligence operative. And he used to go to Europe on a regular basis, quite regularly. And he was smuggling German scientists out from under the noses of the Nazis, most of them Jewish, some not, and pulling them over to the U.S. through the auspices of the company store. And then he would hide them in a big house in Long Island for a while and give them a disguise. And then they went into hiding until the war was over. When the war was over, they went to work with all of the other people who came over from Europe under Operation Paperclip.
Mm.
But that was some of Father's operations. He had ready access to Europe. I did not know why or what was going on at that time. But when my schooling was finished, he picked me up. We went to Scotland, picked up Duncan when he had finished his schooling. And in late August, we went to Germany to visit my natural mother,
mm.
who was living in her castle in Königsberg.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that very well because it was a brown sandstone castle, not as ornate as some of the earlier ones. I have no idea when it was built. She was there with the servants and everything else. And it was on the river, if I remember correctly. Excuse me while this TV just turned itself on. I've got to shut it off.
Okay.
I have a TV with a mind of its own. Once in a while, it decides to turn itself on. and I met Mother there.
Right.
It was on the river outside of the town of Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad in Russia. At that time, it was the eastern strip, including Prussia.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of it. And when the war started, of course, sometime after that she left there. Do not know the history of when she left, but she did come to the U.S.
Was that the last contact you had with your mother?
That was the last contact I ever had with her. It was in August 1939.
Okay.
Duncan was with me, Father was with me, and we were there, I think, 2 days. And we left, and we immediately got out of Europe, because at that point it was September 1, if I remember correctly, and the war started on the 3rd.
Would you describe your meeting with her as warm?
Very warm, very friendly.
Right.
Very affectionate. She knew, of course, my progress and what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about what had happened to her.
Hmm.
But Father took me over.
What was your relationship with your dad? Did you briefly see him? Were there long periods of time where you did not see him?
While he was still in the Navy, we only saw him once a year, typically around Christmas. He took 2 weeks off, which was more or less standard. I presume he could have taken more time off, but I don't really know what the regulations were then. I know that he took typically 2 weeks off around Christmas, and we would see him over the Christmas holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And I specifically remember one time when he took me in, for whatever reason it was, before Christmas, to the Arnold Constable store in Brooklyn. And the time when the memory came back, it was crystal clear, the English-cut doors with the scroll work, the inlaid glass and so forth in the doors, and the mantle, the lintel piece over the door with the fancy metal scrolls and all that sort of thing, very English in its style. We went through the store, and I remember sitting out in the back of the store. There was a window viewing on a pond frozen, of course, at that time of the year, and there was ice skaters on it. I didn't have any concern about the store as such, because at that time I was still essentially in high school. And actually, grade school, still not quite out of grade school.
Mm-hmm.
And the store didn't concern me as such, but I do remember it, having been there. Father took me there once. I was not with Duncan at that time. So whether it's business or what, I don't really know.
Was Duncan your older or younger brother?
Younger brother. I was the oldest in the family.
Okay.
I was the first born, Duncan was second. And if there are others, we didn't know about them at that time. I do know there were other brothers, but by whose, who was the woman, I do not know. We had a younger brother, Jim, 6 years younger. He enlisted in the Navy and was one of those who wound up dying on the Eldridge.
Right.
And there's also another brother that turned up about 2 years ago, contacted me through Vince Barbara, publisher of the series of Montauk books. And he got a letter from Europe and forwarded it to me. It was from somebody who claimed to be a missing brother. He was born in 1950. And this is a letter I got just about 2 years ago, and told me the history of that, and I called him and talked with him at length on the phone.
What was his name?
I couldn't even tell you now. I'd have to look it up. I've still got the letters here.
Okay, so we have Jim as a possible younger brother. Or
He was not by the family in the United States. It was probably one of Father's extracurricular activities when he was over in Europe, because he told me he was born in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And that was long after Duncan and I.
Yeah, yeah.
He's definitely a younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's in his 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me a very interesting thing, which shed a great deal of light on Father's hidden activities.
Mm-hmm.
When Father left the Navy, the excuse was, and I'm not saying it was not valid, that he had a heart murmur and the Navy didn't want him anymore, so they retired him honorably and they gave him a pension. And he lived off that pension for years. Well, he had other money, but we'd never been able to find it, because he smuggled nine people out of Europe from under the noses of the Nazis to the United States, some of whom became involved in other research programs at a later date after the war was over. But at that time, the going stipend for smuggling somebody out of Nazi Germany to the United States was 50% of your assets. Now, after the war was hot, like we were involved in it, well, they were still bringing people out. At that time, I'm quite sure it went up to the usual thing, oh, you want to escape this and go to the U.S.? What are you worth? We'll take it. I mean, it's 100% all of your assets.
So you think your dad got a nice percentage cut?
Father got a very nice piece of it, maybe mm-hmm. most of it. I don't know the details.
Mm-hmm.
They only know that the rumors run through the family for years that he had a stash someplace, and it has never been found.
Mm. When's the last time that you ever saw your father?
The last time I ever saw him was in 1942 or 3. There was opportunity to see him after that, but he became involved with Operation Paperclip, and I was assigned first to Los Alamos and then later on to another operation, but I never saw him again during that period. And can't say now why not, but I didn't, because he did live on until 1985. Now, his official record says that he died in 1981, but we found out otherwise. There had been a rumor circulating quite heavily in Long Island for years that he didn't die in 81 in the hospital out of a coma. He recovered and lived secretly and without apparently any money, which again is a question mark,
mm-hmm.
on Long Island, voiding the family, because he'd already given all of his property and any assets he was known to have had already been divided up between Duncan and his sister and someone else in the family.
Well, he would have been quite an old man. I guess that would have made him around 96, 96 years old?
In 1985, when he actually did die, and we were able to trace that finally,
mm-hmm.
he was 94 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in 1891.
Okay.
Now, what happened, we found this out, was rather curious. This is, again, jumping a little bit ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But when this missing brother called me, he told me that he was an adopted son also. He didn't know who his father was until 1956, when his father, that is my father, Alexander Duncan Cameron Sr., comes to Germany, picks the young boy up at the age of six and takes him to a garden party in Dortmund, Germany. And he says, here I was in this garden party running around with all these people. And he says, I clearly remember who was there. And I says, well, who was? He says, well, first, my father. And my father also. But he said, I'm hobnobbing with some very strange people. He said, I didn't understand what it was all about. I says, well, who was he hobnobbing with? He says, first of all, there was President Eisenhower from the United States, Winston Churchill from England, Charles de Gaulle from France, and Joe Stalin from Russia. And my father was running around with these people? That's exactly what my brother reported.
Wow. And where was this physically located?
This was in Dortmund, Germany.
Germany.
1956.
Wow.
Well, this I passed on to some other people, and they started checking records furiously.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, if he was mixed up with that, he had to have a very high-level clearance. So a friend of mine who has connections found out that he indeed did have a very high-level clearance, so a level 7 clearance, which is well above presidential, and also some other clearances thrown in by the Pentagon. He was working for the Pentagon, and all during that period. Curiously enough, in my the last years of my career, I wound up working for the Pentagon as Ed Cameron. But father passed on finally in 85, just before I moved, before I made my visit to Long Island in August of 85.
Okay, so that's quite a bit of time there between 43 and 85 that you never had contact with him.
I never had contact with him knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a friend in Texas who was a psychic, a real sensitive. At the time when I knew nothing whatever about my family, and I'm talking about my life as Al Bielek,
right.
She insisted that I had two brothers, which turned out to be true, mm-hmm. and a father who would occasionally look in on me to make sure I was all right. And I said, I don't know who you're talking about. My father, this was in the 60s. My father was dead. Mother was still alive. My legal parents, mm-hmm. the ones I knew was my parents until I found out otherwise.
This lady
now also dead quite a few years. She died of protracted cancer and other illnesses. She was right on the money, and I had no idea how she knew this.
Hmm.
But she was absolutely correct. I had two brothers. I'm talking about brothers that were alive. And the father looked in on me occasionally. Now, how he did this, I don't know. He probably, through his intelligence connections, knew where I was at any one time, or just come by, look at me, maybe in a public place. Who knows how he arranged it, but I never saw him. If I did, I certainly didn't know who he was.
Hmm.
There was no occasion when I ever saw anybody that I say that didn't fit the surroundings or the people I knew at that time.
So he did it very quietly.
They did it very, very quietly, believe me.
Well, that was his business, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
That was his business, though.
That was his business, absolutely.
He'd be a pro at doing that.
No, he was obviously very good at it.
Mm-hmm. But it obviously also shows that he cared for you, too.
It would say that, yes, very definitely. In fact, that was my psychic friend said, that he could have definitely cared about me and what was happening to me.
Hmm.
I said, well, I asked at the time, if this is the case, why doesn't he identify himself with me? And I never got a straight answer on that, but I could answer that question now very well. But
yeah.
Obviously
he couldn't.
I could not have.
Right. Well, let's go back to
Ed Cameron.
Well, yeah, we're on Ed Cameron right now, and we've gotten all the way to the point of Harvard, and I'm assuming both you and your brother went through Harvard to get your PhD together?
No, my brother stayed in University of Edinburgh in Scotland.
To get his PhD?
PhD in physics there. I took mine out of Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Europe. We came back, left Europe on the 1st of September. The war formally broke out, I believe, on the 3rd. And I believe we flew, but there wasn't very much in the way of overseas operations airline at that time. I think
mm-hmm.
Pan Am was the only one that was flying overseas, though I'm not sure of that. But anyway, we came back to New York, and Father insisted that Duncan and I enlisted in the Navy, following the family tradition, you know,
mm-hmm.
that hoopla. So we I said, all right, why not? We little knew that Father had already set everything up for us. But he had, and we joined the Navy in 50 Church Street, New York, and was sworn in and was given commission to Lieutenant J.G. because of the fact we had PhDs and we were already slated for a certain special project, which we didn't know.
What year did you graduate from Harvard?
1939, summer.
Okay. So it sounds like both of you graduated pretty much at the same time.
We did. We both entered the university at the same time, and we both graduated at the same time.
Huh.
We both finished high school at the age of 16.
Well, he was what, 2 years younger than you, though?
No, he was about 7 months younger.
7 months younger. Okay.
It was close enough to my age that he still fitted in the pattern.
Okay, and he graduated from high school early, too.
Yes.
I got it. Okay. So both of you have your PhDs, and now you're back.
We're enlisting in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sent to one of the 90-day wonder schools in Connecticut for officers who were slated for special projects.
Do you remember where in Connecticut this was?
I think it was Groton, but I'm not sure now.
Isn't that where the submarine base is?
I believe it is.
Groton, Connecticut. Okay,
yeah.
Right.
And when that was finished, we were told, all right, you want to report in for your assignment, and we were given or orders to go to the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to leave in the meantime. So we arrived there in January, early January 1940. And we were introduced around. We were not sure how we were set up in terms of assignment. There was a local Navy constabulary in Princeton somewheres in the city or town, but actually most of the Navy connections we had turned out to be through the Navy Yard in Philadelphia. But we reported in and got our quarters, and we were assigned to Dr. John von Neumann. And we were two brash young PhDs out of school, and just finished our 90-day wonder school training for the Navy to let us know what the Navy was about. And assigned to this project. Well, yes, Don Neumann, what's this project we're assigned to? Well, you're going to be working with us. So not just myself, but other people, including Nikola Tesla,
mm-hmm.
on Project Invisibility.
Well, wasn't it quite a surprise for you to see Dr. John von Neumann again in this school?
It was rather a surprise to see that he was attached to this project,
mm-hmm.
yes. But he alluded all along that he was working on another project. He wasn't at the school all the time. At the Institute, of course, was on Princeton property.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a matter of walking, literally, from the Institute properties to the university. And he was teaching in the graduate school.
Did you get any feeling that he had kind of privately said to someone... Hey, That he privately said to someone, hey, I want this guy on my team?
I still can't understand you.
Oh, did you get the feeling that sort of privately he said, hey, I want this guy, Ed Cameron, on my team. I know him. He was a student of mine.
Could well have been. What all arrangements were made in the background, with whom and how, I don't know. I only know that Father had it set up. We found that out later.
Mm-hmm.
And the skids were well greased, you might say, for arrival at the Institute and to work on this project. Now, specifically why we were chosen to work on the project, I don't know, but our duties were basically, as we found out, to keep tabs on the project, understand exactly what they're doing, and write monthly reports and contribute whatever help we could to the project. Now, of course, at that point in January 1940, they still had not had a successful test. They'd had an aborted one in 1936 for invisibility, which didn't work, but at least gave them some indication, and they're probably working in the right direction, but they had not yet had a fully functional test of invisibility. So von Neumann sat us down in one of the makeshift classrooms, of which I still have pictures, as I went back there to Princeton and mm-hmm. through the whole Institute area and the lab building, because we were working in a brand-new lab building that had just been finished that year, 1939, that is, and we started in 1940, so the lab building was not quite a year old.
Mm-hmm.
And sat us down and said, well, what do they teach you in physics, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you're going to have to brush up on quantum physics. You're going to have to, which he had helped to invent, I might add. He was one of the avant-garde scientists working on quantum physics.
Hmm.
You're going to have to brush up on that. You're going to have to learn about, in fact, you're going to have to unlearn quite a bit of what you learned in the school. Oh.
Which he taught you.
And said you weren't taught correctly about gravity. You weren't taught correctly about time and time fields, et cetera. Gave us, of course, quite a few references. And brought us personally up to speed on the project and what we were doing and why the invisibility should work. At that time, it was, of course, a should work proposition. And as time went on, of course, they built some hardware, and they, Tesla was there after he had finished up his work with RCA, retired from the position he had there. They had a huge retirement party for him in Cherry Hill. That was shown in some of the RCA bulletins, but I've never been able to get my hands on any of those. There were those who had worked there and told me they remembered the bulletin with his retirement party.
Mm-hmm.
But after he retired, he was almost full-time on the project. He still had other projects and things he was working on, which he never alluded to other than indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
But he was there full-time, and since he was the director, of course, all of the ideas involved with the project were basically his. And what we had to learn was that basically, yeah, electric fields we know about, and electric fields are electric fields, and magnetic fields we know about, but you don't really know about how a magnetic field really works, and we had to straighten us out on that. And then there's a gravity field. Gravity field? Oh, I thought there was a mutual attraction of matter for matter. That's what they taught us in the school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, going back to this mathematician physicist 200 years ago, had an apple hit him on the head, and this, oh, gravity, came up with his feelings and statements, expressed, of course, in long mathematical equations, that gravity is a mutual attraction of matter for matter, and you can calculate the mass effect and the gravity effect and all of that.
I believe that's still how they teach it today.
That is still how they teach it today, and it's a total lie. 100%. Mézé knew in 1939, in 1940, at the Institute. And, of course, NASA had to find that out the hard way themselves when we started to send rockets out into space to attempt to go to the moon.
Right. We'll get into that a little later.
Yeah, that's later.
Right.
But in any case, he taught us about the correct views on gravity and so forth and what time is and how you can manipulate time. They already had a theory based on Einstein's completed unified field theory, which was completed the second time, you might say, in 1938. He originally had it completed, he thought, in 1929 and gave a copy to Lord Russell in England to review. Russell came back to him and said, the world is not ready for this. I suggest you withdraw it and maybe announce that there's some errors in it or something. So Einstein did that, said he found errors in it and he had to withdraw it to correct it.
Right.
Well, he did make some changes, and it was released in 1938 as complete, but as classified then, as still classified to this day.
What do you think was in there that the world was not ready for?
Well, that was Russell's opinion. Perhaps the fact that you could use these equations for time travel. Perhaps that was what Russell was alluding to. I don't know, as I never knew Russell. And I've only read a little bit about his writings and his work. But in any case, we use those equations of Einstein's, plus some additional work that was done by an MIT mathematician who was very much into time equations and the time matrix. And all of that together, I'll remember his name in a minute, came together to produce the overall set of equations which they used to produce invisibility. What they were trying to do, and eventually did do, was produce a localized warp in the time field which would surround the object you wanted to make invisible. And if the warp was of proper intensity and strength, not enough to make the object move through time, but enough to distort light waves and electromagnetic waves and so forth, so they would pass around the object or through the object. And there was still, I think, a point and debatable at that time whether the light was going through it or around it. But if you don't get reflection off the object, you don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up for just a second. You talked about them teaching you a lot of new physics, in a sense. Was that so that you could help them actually develop enough more physics, I guess, so that you could complete the project? Or is it so that you would have an understanding of the project?
Basically, it was so I would have an understanding of the project, and Duncan, of course, with me. And they wanted us to understand the project,
mm-hmm.
understand the theory, know what the equipment was supposed to do and how it was supposed to work, so we could write intelligent reports, because apparently we're the only observers for the Department of the Navy on the project who was eventually going to fund it. Mm-hmm. At that point, the Navy was funding it, but under the table. Grant money and this sort of thing that went to the Institute to continue this project.
So you were in an operations role rather than a development role?
That is correct.
Okay.
And, of course, it became fully operations role when it came to the actual tests on the ship in 43.
Mm-hmm.
But that's getting a little ahead of the story.
Right.
Now, they built some equipment, put it on a Navy tender, a small ship, approximately 350 tons. They used the smallest one they could find because they wanted to test the system at low power and see if the theory wore out, whether it worked or not, did not work. So they picked a small tender, which was in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and put the equipment on board the ship, which included a special antenna system and some coils on the deck, and it was tied dockside, and the rest of the operating equipment was off the pier with long cables to the ship. They made sure that the ship was in a docking area where there was considerable clearance from any of the dock facilities themselves, and it was run with long cables.
Do you remember the name of this ship?
No, I do not.
Okay.
It's long gone. In terms of the memory, I was not even there that much. I was there once. I'm not, at this point, I don't recall that I was actually even there for the test. We saw the movie films later.
Mm-hmm.
But they removed all personnel from the ship when they had everything ready to go. Turned the equipment on, and yep, ship became completely invisible. They definitely wanted to film it because they wanted to see whether it was an optical illusion involving the eye or whether it was a true optical phenomena which could be photographed. And it was photographable. And the ship became invisible.
Hmm.
So with that, of course, the Navy was elated, Roosevelt was elated, and everybody working on the project was happy because they had finally done it.
What year again was this?
It was September 1939.
Okay. That's right when you graduated from Princeton.
I'm sorry, September 1940. What am I saying?
Okay.
September 1940. Exactly 1 year later from when I joined the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, of course, the Navy says, okay, we are taking the project over now. It shall become classified. They gave it a name, Project Rainbow, which was the early name in which it was known. And everything's classified, and everyone working on it's classified, and so forth and so on, and we will fund the project from here on, but we want the same people still working on it. So Neumann was still with it, Tuzzle was with it, and whatever other staff personnel from the Institute were with it, and, of course, Duncan and myself. And shortly thereafter, Roosevelt announced to Tuzzle, who I presume was called down to Washington for another little conference, and he says, well, you've made that ship invisible. He says, I'm going to give you a real ship to make invisible. He says, if you can make a battleship invisible, you can make anything invisible. So Roosevelt ordered a battleship into the Philadelphia Navy Yard. No problems, plenty of space there.
Mm-hmm.
Into the back section where they did the classified work, and they proceeded to work on that. Well, this went on through December of 1940, and they were making preparations, and of course, Tesla and everybody involved had to decide how much power was going to be required and what kind of equipment to build. In January 1941, the Navy pulled Duncan and I out of there for another operation because apparently they suspected it was going to take quite a while before that ship would be ready for test. And they sent us out to sea on the USS Pennsylvania. And we were floating around the Pacific and wherever the Pennsylvania went, which is mostly the Pacific, until October of 1941, when it came into Pearl Harbor and went into dry dock for overhaul. And we were locally footloose, and eventually we took leave and went to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on December 5th, we received orders which were cut for our return to Pearl Harbor. Actually, the orders a few days before that, and they were cut for our return to Pearl Harbor on the 5th of December, 1941. Well, of course, you and I and everybody knows what happened on the 7th.
Oh, yeah.
And we were about to board a plane to the Naval Air Station in Alameda when we were stopped, and the Navy captain came to us and said, gentlemen, your orders are canceled. Come with me. followed him and went upstairs room in the Naval Air Station. We met Hal Bowen Sr., who was also a captain, and he was the director of the Office of Naval Engineering,
mm-hmm.
as they called it then. It's now known as the Office of Naval Research.
Mm-hmm.
And from 1946, it was ONE. And he says, gentlemen, your orders are canceled. We have reason to believe the Japanese are going to attack Pearl Harbor within the next 48 to 72 hours, and we don't want you there. You're too valuable to us.
Wow.
So we said, take the rest of you leave, the rest of your tour time with the Pennsylvania here in San Francisco. You'll be returned to the Institute in January. And so this is the home port for the Pennsylvania anyway. And of course, 2 days later, Pearl Harbor was hit. The Pennsylvania was not bombed, but it was hit with flying shrapnel, which didn't do much damage. They floated it and took it back to San Francisco and finished the overhaul in San Francisco. That's a matter of public record.
Well, you know, what you're saying there really rewrites our knowledge of history on how the Pearl Harbor incident actually happened.
A. Roosevelt and Secretary of the Army Marshall knew all about it because they set it up. They set it up to goad the Japanese into attacking to get us into the war on the side of England. And on Saturday night before the bombing, on Saturday, December 6th,
mm-hmm.
The entire fleet was ordered to tie up into Pearl Harbor on Saturday night. All of the battle wagons in the Pacific Fleet, all of the cruisers, destroyers, all the other ships, the only ones that were not included in that order were two carriers which were out at sea, and Bull Halsey was controlling those with his associated fleet. He came into Pearl Harbor on the morning of December 7th, right after the first wave of Japanese bombers and torpedo planes had finished. And he took one look at this. This is also public record.
Hmm.
He says, my God, get these ships refueled and get the hell out of here. He says, we don't know whether they're going to come back. And, of course, they did. He got his carriers out. And, of course, Yamamoto, who was the fleet commander, knew that the carriers had not been hit, were loose, and he couldn't find them. He didn't know where they were. Of course, they didn't have radar. We didn't mm-hmm. have good radar in 41 either.
Mm-hmm.
And the carriers escaped, and Yamamoto decided, well, I do not have orders from the emperor to occupy the islands. The American Navy and the American military personnel thought they were going to attempt to occupy Pearl Harbor and the entire Hawaiian chain.
Mm-hmm.
And they were prepared for that. They had already armed all the civilian personnel 2 months in advance. Everyone on the island of Oahu carried a .45, every male.
So they would have had a tough time occupying that island.
They knew what was coming
on
the island, even though the public in general in the United States did not.
Well, they probably didn't even have enough personnel, the Japanese, that is, to occupy the island.
Well, they didn't have that many Japanese personnel there. They were removed later, of course, in the famous operation of Japanese behind barbed wire.
No, I mean the Japanese who attacked Pearl Harbor.
The Japanese fleet did not know the true status of Pearl Harbor. They did not even know how much damage they'd done.
Hmm.
If they had any idea how much damage they'd done, they would have probably moved in. But he did not have orders to do so. So mm-hmm. Yamamoto turned back and he says, I have to protect the fleet.
Mm-hmm.
So he returned steaming towards Japan, and we'll drop that point there. But
Halsey
never found them at that time. What happened later, of course, is history.
Sure. But let's go back a little bit because we're jumping around some.
Okay.
When you actually started this program with your brother, did you live with your brother? Were you close with him?
You mean in terms of our daily life, so to speak?
Yeah, your daily life. Yeah.
While we were there at the Institute?
Yeah, sort of the part that hasn't been told yet. Do you recall any of that?
No, as I remember, we did not live together as such. We had quarters on base. We also had quarters off base. Being as we're officers, and I don't know when we achieved the rank, but we're both given the rank. excuse me, both given the rank of captain
mm-hmm.
Prior to the 43 test, and we had all space off on base. And I used to go running around quite a bit in the, shall we say, the high society of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So did Duncan. And he had a girlfriend. I went over the girlfriend who was intended to marry, and I was engaged to her
mm-hmm.
during the summer of 43.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, she was pregnant, and so we got engaged. And the marriage was consummated after the trying to remember the sequence here. It was consummated after the 43 test, the two tests in 43. In fact, all three of them on the Eldridge.
Mm-hmm.
But the
So there's at least one son that we know of from Ed
Cameron.
Yes,
there's one son, which is mine.
Okay.
There were four more children by various unknown parties, shall we say, that were all born in New Mexico. I've only been able to track down number two and number three.
Mm-hmm.
I have no knowledge of number four or number five.
So you're saying there's Ed Cameron has a total of five children?
That's correct.
Okay. And it's been very difficult for you since
extremely difficult.
You're Al Bielek. And
I've never been allowed to meet son number one. It's always been blocked by the government mm-hmm. or agents posing as the government, as the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
We know that some of them were CIA. Of course, they play some very dirty games with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing at keeping me from meeting Jeff. My number one son's name is Jeff, Jeffrey D. Cameron. And he was all right for him to meet with Preston Nichols, but he could never meet with me.
Hmm.
Now, of course, this is getting into aspects of where it was Al Bielek, but prior to that, of course, the son was born in February 1944. This was after all the tests were over. And I married just before that, and getting married was a problem because the Navy didn't even want me to meet my girlfriend, didn't want me to marry her, but I arranged it through Dr. John von Neumann. I figured he had enough clout around the university, he could arrange it somehow or other, and he did. He set it up for me to get married in the Navy Chapel, but the chapel, which was actually the Princeton property chapel, but arranged it with a naval chaplain.
Have you been able to do any follow-up on your wife at that time?
She's long since dead from a car wreck. That happened in 1957.
Do you recall her name?
As I recall, it was Mary Jane.
Mary Jane.
But it's so far back, I'm not completely sure of that.
Okay.
I've never found any records for her, and I've not been able to find any records for Jeff or any of the others. And when the records were found of some of the other two, the other number two and number three, and they were able to find out that they were not who they thought they were, but were connected with me, all hell broke loose in terms of political problems, military problems. One was involved with a political scenario in Long Island. Number three was involved with the Marine Corps. He was in the Marine Corps. They yanked him right out of his leave from Long Island, returned him to Camp Lejeune, and shipped him overseas into the Middle East. And he's never been back since. Except once or twice to visit on leave.
Wow.
And it's all right for him to visit with some of the other people, but he was never allowed to visit or talk with me. There's standing orders from his military commanders that he shall not talk with either myself or Preston Nichols.
So you're saying that you have actually seen some of these sons?
Yes, I've seen number two and number three. They know who I am. They did not, and I did not, when I first met them.
Hmm.
That was why I had no problem meeting them. Nobody knew they were related to me.
Was it a very brief meeting that you had with him?
I'm sorry?
Was it very brief, the meeting that you had with?
No, it was repeated. This happened in January of 97, overlapping into the end of 96. I was on Long Island visiting Preston,
mm-hmm.
and one of the Montauk boys, as he called them, had a six-bedroom house he was living in, and he had a girlfriend who was in and out. And Preston talked with me. She says, I got lots of spare room here. Why don't you have Al stay with me?
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I had no idea who he was. Yes, he was a Montauk boy.
Hmm.
But I don't want to get ahead of the story, but eventually, due to some of Preston's deprogramming techniques, we were able to break him through some of the aspects of his programming, and then on a sheer hunch, I showed him a picture of number one son, who I had determined since was number one son, though I had not met him. A number of people have identified him, including Preston, in a personal visit, which he tried to visit with me, but I wasn't there.
This is Jeff, right?
Jeff, yes.
Okay.
Showed him Morgan, a number two son, a picture of Jeff. He weren't clear through the ceiling.
Hmm.
I asked him, do you have any chance I happen to know this guy or recognize him? He says, know him, hell. He said he used to visit me over in Germany all the time while I was growing up over there.
Hmm.
I said, oops. And then we started to get into some of the deeper aspects of what is still unresolved in terms of some of the background of my life that overlaps from Ed Cameron to Al Bielek. But Jeff was back and forth and saw Morgan many times. Morgan remembered it. We finally tracked down that Morgan's birth certificate was phony and that he was my number two son. He does recognize it now, but I don't see him anymore because he got involved with local politics and some dirty pool politics on the island, and I've not had an occasion to go out there to see him since.
Well, when you were Ed Cameron and you had these five children, did you get to know him very well?
No. My only one I ever got to know at all was Jeff. The reason was Jeff was born in 44, and because I stayed with the family stayed with me. Even though they were off base when the experiments took place, when that was over, I was back with the family. And in 1944, von Neumann, who was then, since late 43, working on the bomb project at Los Alamos, New Mexico laboratories, invited me, asked me if I'd be interested in coming up there, and I said, sure. Because I was in limbo with the Navy, didn't know what to do with me. I stayed at the Philadelphia Navy Yard area, but they didn't know what to do with me in terms of assignment.
This is the end of the Philadelphia experiment.
That was after the three phases of the test and the others was over.
And I think what we'll do is we'll do another program that just gets into the Philadelphia experiment.
Yes,
all by itself,
handled separately.
Right.
And when von Neumann made the suggestion, said, "Oh, sure, fine with me," except you'll have to talk to my superiors, and he did, and they thought it was a great idea to transfer me to Los Alamos because that was one of those super secret, it doesn't exist laboratories.
Yeah.
At that point, nobody knew about it except those working there and certain elements of the military and, of course, the White House. But they transferred me to Los Alamos with family.
This is the
July of 44.
Same family, Mary Jane?
Yeah.
Being
and
your wife?
Jeff. That was the
and Jeff.
Sole size of the family at that time.
Okay.
Now, there were no more children born to my wife. I don't know why not. Whether there wasn't a problem with me, because I had plenty of kids by other women, but I don't know why there was no more with her. I do not know the answer to that one. It just weren't. But in any case, we were assigned to Los Alamos to become part of the project from July 44 through July 4th, 1947. And during that period of time, I was working with von Neumann, helped him any way I could, and of course the Navy wanted me to keep a running record of everything that was going on up there. I was the official eyes for the Navy, if you will. And of course all the services had an interest in the development of the bomb. At that point it was a pure scientific research program, though highly classified.
Well, this was before the CIA, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
This time that you're talking about was
long before the CIA or the NSA.
Right, so
it was Naval Intelligence was involved in the background.
Right, so every department of had their own intelligence.
Correct.
And so they had their people, kind of like what the CIA does now. They
yes,
had their people in different organizations.
Yeah, well, the CIA, of course, has now people of theirs in many different organizations and many different groups, as does NSA.
So you were kind of like a CIA insider, in a sense.
Except it wasn't CIA. It was
correct.
ONI, if you will, Office of Naval Intelligence Insider. Though I wasn't working for Naval Intelligence as such. I was working for the, basically, for people at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
I was reporting there, though I didn't physically go there until after this was over. But I was up there making my reports, and instructions were to help any way I could with von Neumann, with the bomb and so forth, and the development of it. And there wasn't much I could do because his math was a bit better than mine.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person we ran into, of course, was there were many. That's all public record. Ed Teller was there. He was smuggled into the U.S. in 1943, and he became a major part of the project from the time when the labs were actually opened. They moved him in there shortly after. The labs officially, in that is in secret, opened for business about October of 43.
Was he German?
I'm sorry?
Ed Teller, was he German?
Hungarian.
Hungarian, okay.
They smuggled him out from behind the Iron Curtain.
That
was a very major operation.
Okay.
I don't know whether my father had anything to do with that or not. I've never read the records as to how they got him over, but I know they smuggled him out.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a major part of the bomb, of course. The history is fairly well known publicly. There are aspects of it are not known, but they had their test at Trinity Flat July 17th, and I believe it was, in 1945. It was fully successful. And, of course, about a week later, they dropped a bomb on Japan, one of the old gun barrel uranium types.
Mm-hmm.
And then several days to a week later, they dropped a second bomb on Japan at Nagasaki, which was a plutonium device. And this is where things get very strange. Because to develop and test the bomb, which they tested at Trinity Flats, and it was noted and is in the public record, so I'm not telling anything here that's not public, publicly known and declassified, it stated right in the public record that all of the production of plutonium that could come out of Hanford Engineering Works went into that test bomb at Trinity Flats. There wasn't any more left. They used it all. And they were so concerned about the fact that prior tests had been duds, because there had been other tests prior to Trinity Flats. And they were concerned about the fact that the others were duds. If this one was a dud, they wanted to be able to salvage the plutonium that was left. So they built a huge iron or steel shell around the bomb to salvage any plutonium that might not go off in the bomb if the bomb was proved to be a dud.
Mm-hmm.
This is all in the public record. It's very curious.
So where did they get the plutonium then?
I'm sorry?
Where, the question is, where did they get the plutonium?
Well, for the first Trinity Flats test, it all came from Hanford.
Mm-hmm.
And it went off, of course, and was a complete success. So, yes, where did they get the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb? That has never been answered.
Mm.
Hanford couldn't grind enough out in a period of a month, or much less 3 weeks, to satisfy the requirements for the second plutonium bomb.
Do you have any thoughts on where they might have gotten
it? I know exactly where it came from.
Ah.
And it wasn't from that time. This involves another project, which eventually I became involved with, but that's much later.
As Al Bielik?
Time manipulation and time travel.
Now that's going to shock a few folks.
I'm sorry?
That will shock a few folks.
Yes, it would. We won World War II by virtue of the fact that we had solved time travel in 1938 due to an accidental discovery in 1936 in the U.S. The Germans were working on it also, and they had some kind of a working system before the war was over. There were a lot of rumors that they used it, but I've never seen anything that I would consider hard data, other than the fact that all the scientists in Germany came to the U.S. and went to Brookhaven National Laboratories to continue their research on, one, time travel, and two, mind control.
Well, yeah, this accidental discovery, was that by Dr. John von Neumann? Or?
No. No, it was due to a very strange sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
In 1935, a brand new carrier known as the USS Kearsarge was launched. I should say it was commissioned in 1935. I'm not sure exactly when it was launched. I have to go back in the records. But usually at that stage, they were nearly finished when they were launched for a carrier. And it was commissioned in 1935, and it began traveling around the world. And the earliest, some of the early ships, of course, were still coal-fired in World War two prior period of 10 years, they still built some coal-fired. It was converted to oil before the war was over. And the Kearsarge has a strange history, but in that period around 1936, it was touring around the South Atlantic, just north of the coast of South America, in what could be considered the fringe area of the Bermuda Triangle. And whether or not the Navy knew anything about the, quote, Bermuda Triangle, unquote, at that time, I do not know. But in any case, they found or sensed, whether it's by sonar or what, I don't know, because the story was not complete as I read it. And this was, I read up in the Black Vault in Los Alamos. They found a very strange crystal formation on the floor of the ocean, so they sent divers down to examine it. Standard hard hat divers. It wasn't doing very deep there. And they were looking at this thing, and it appeared to be a single-piece crystal of a very strange formation, very large. By large, I mean 20, 30 feet across. That's apparently a single piece.
Wow.
Of course, it excited their interest. What the hell is this thing? Nothing like this exists naturally. Well, it didn't. It wasn't natural. That's finding the history of that out, of course, didn't happen until many, many years later. But in any case, while they're probing around down there, all of a sudden the USS Kearsarge disappears. It just goes, boop, and it's gone.
Wow.
What happened to the divers, I'm not sure. I don't know if they went with it or not. I would assume they did, but I didn't read anything in there about divers' bodies being found later.
So this
and the ship was gone, and nobody could figure out what happened. All radio communications with it ceased, etc. Of course, they had modern radio, teletype, and all of that.
This is a report that you were reading
yes.
while you're at Los Alamos in the Black Vault.
Okay. That's correct. And about 2 months later, it returned, essentially to the same area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, they started communicating as normal. They would. They were descended upon by everybody in the Navy, practically. What happened? Where were you? Et cetera, et cetera. It seems like what happened, and they were told this where they went. They actually time traveled into the future. To what point, I don't know. And they were told there that they had activated one of the old Atlantean crystal bed sites, which the Atlantis and the Atlantean civilization had used for travel, of not time travel, but for transportation of very large and very heavy payloads, such as, let's say, a barge full of cut granite. They were going to use for some monument or something. I'm just giving you an illustration.
Something like a pyramid?
And, yeah, if they wanted to use it for a pyramid, whatever. There is a pyramid underwater in that general area, about a little north of there. And they would place it over this area, excited with the proper electromagnetic frequencies. And the item, the barge, whatever was there, would be instantly transported to another point on the planet where there was another crystal formation. They were all over the planet, and they used it for transporting very heavy loads with no power. That is, no power other than to excite the crystals. And they didn't have to haul them, taking all kinds of time. It was a beautiful transportation system. Well, of course, when Atlantis went down, lots of relics were left behind, including these. And it just happened, as they were told, you happened to hit the right combination of frequencies to turn this thing into a transport device into the future. So they told them how to calibrate it and how to get back to where they came from, which they did. And then, of course, there was furious research and cover-up in the Navy as to how do you use this thing.
Have you ever met with any of the people who were on this ship when it disappeared?
No, but I have met with one person who knew the whole story. And we discussed this at length. And we discussed at length the fact that after this technique was developed, it was put on other ships. It was put on the U.S., apparently on the USS Furuseth, and quite a few ships, because they used them to go into the future to get hardware to come back and fight Hitler with, and apparently also Japan.
So you attribute our success in World War II as to our ability to go into the future and get the necessary technology so that we could win the war.
Exactly. Hitler was so far advanced, let us say, not just, it wasn't Hitler per se, it was the whole German establishment, but scientifically far advanced over anyone else on the planet.
Were they doing the same thing?
I don't know if they were doing that technique. I do not know for sure whether they really had time travel. That was the reports we heard.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have very advanced technologies. They had operational jets in 1939, 1940, jet aircraft. They solved the anti-gravity problem with two different research programs, one for the SS Group 4 and the other was the Austrian scientist, physicist who developed the system, which gave them anti-gravity, and they built, not many apparently, but they did build circular foil aircraft, UFOs if you want to call them that, in the same format, the same circular design, and they had anti-gravity drives for them.
I guess they just didn't have enough to...
They did not have enough. The only thing they had enough of to start to make a dent were the Foo Fighters. That was a German development. And they were shielded by the drive itself produced a distorting field around the craft, which was quite small. It was a one-man or two-man craft with armaments, which was designed to come up to our bomber fleets, take aim, fire at them, and bring the planes down. They did. They brought quite a few planes down. If they had more of those Foo Fighters, which were well recovered at the time and reported, and was even in a report in the Liberty magazine as well as in the general press, nobody knew what the Foo Fighters were. They assumed they were alien, but they weren't. They were German. They actually started to bring the fleets down. They didn't bring enough down to make a real difference because we were sending 1,500 planes over at a time in each raid. You'd have to knock out more than 500 to make a major difference.
I'd say so. Well, let's go back to Los Alamos because that's kind of where we vectored off from.
Well, I found the report there, and this is what we uncovered. And
so you're saying from that report, you were able to find out that we went into the future to get the plutonium necessary.
Right, and I also realized something else then.
Okay.
That if we had this kind of technology from 1938 on, as I asked the question to some of the other people I knew there, says, what the hell did we ever bother with the Philadelphia experiment for?
Mm-hmm.
There was an unanswered question, and that caused a lot of ripples. But what really got me into trouble...
Who did you ask that question to?
I asked it of... I asked it of Neumann. He could not come up with an answer on it because he was enmeshed in it completely himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked it of the lab director, Dr. What was his name?
Is it Teller?
Not Teller, no. I didn't talk with Teller on that. At that point, I was on the outs with Teller. Teller and I were having problems
mm-hmm.
between us.
Okay.
The director of the labs was...
Well, it was a while ago.
There was a well-known guy. Can't think of his name at the moment. But I asked him about it. He couldn't come up with any answers because he was totally unfamiliar with the whole thing. But I got back to the Navy in Washington, and they weren't happy about it, but they didn't do anything. So what finally happened was that I was at odds with Dr. Teller repeatedly because when the war was over, he immediately wanted to develop the hydrogen bomb. And he was blocked by the lab director, as well as I sided with the lab director, that this is not something we need or should even bother to develop. Well, Teller didn't like that. And finally, I told Teller, I says, look, I've looked at your math, your equations, your math is flawed. I says, you cannot predict the size of the yield on a fusion device. I said, on a fission device, there's no problem. I said, on a fusion device, you cannot predict the size of this thing, what's going to happen to it. And he was furious, madder than a wet hen. He had a bad temper to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of made it worse. And eventually, he decided he had to get me out of there. And there was eventually a meeting held on the 3rd of July, 1947, about what to do about me, because he was so beside himself because of my continually picking at him and the fact that I insisted with the lab director this project should not go ahead, and the lab director had already decided it shouldn't.
Right.
They brought in two outside people to, shall we say, have a little meeting, a three-sided meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know as I want this on the record as to who these three people were.
It's your choice.
In fact, I think it would be best to leave the three off, other than to say that Teller was principally involved.
Mm-hmm.
Teller is still alive. Second man, Dr. Vannevar Bush, who was a scientific advisor to the president,
mm-hmm.
is dead, as I understand now, about 3-4 years. But he was involved in that. He would not cast the vote for my removal.
Mm-hmm.
Teller, of course, did, and so did Kissinger. He was a third man.
Henry Kissinger?
Yes. Teller knew him quite well.
What year was this, though?
Hmm?
What year was this, again?
This was July 3rd, 1947.
Oh. He keeps popping up in a lot of things.
Oh, he's popped up in so many places, you wouldn't believe it. Kissinger is now the director of MJ-12. And guess who was his assistant director? Dr. Edward Teller.
I thought Dr. Edward Teller was dead a long time ago.
No, Teller is very much alive.
Hmm.
Teller is still very much alive. He's in seclusion, so to speak. He still works at the USC and Davis facility, I believe.
Hmm.
And is sort of leading a life of, I would think more accurately, semi-retirement rather than full retirement.
So Kissinger must have been a young man back then, though.
Yes, essentially he was.
How did he get so tied up in all of this stuff?
How did what?
How did Kissinger get tied up in...
I can't even begin to answer that one.
Yeah.
I do know, reading A Secret History of Henry Kissinger, when World War II was over in 1940, nearly over,
mm-hmm.
in 1945, early 45, he was known to be one of the... Par excellence scouters to get the old Nazi SS people and capture them and put them in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a penchant for going after the blonde-haired, blue-eyed types, the Aryans. And he was assigned a whole section of Germany as the supreme ruler. And it took on a castle on the Rhine, which was halfway between, So I was in Germany for a half a year, and I used to pass it all the time and wondered what the hell was that castle on the top of the hill. Eventually I found out. Between Frankfurt on on Main, on the north end, and
Heidelberg?
Not Heidelberg, no. It was another smaller town on the south end, which I was living in or near, actually, in one of the
near
suburbs of Mannheim.
Mannheim. I used to live there.
Mannheim was a major military base, both for the military, the U.S., and also for the German military previously. But on the rail run, which went along the river, you passed this castle. You could see it up on the high banks of the other side of the river.
Right.
And I wondered what it was all about, because every time I went by it, I felt something horrible had taken place in there. Many, many years later, in my doing my political research and digging, I came across a little manual on the life of Henry Kissinger. And it mentioned the fact that during World War II, before it was totally over, he was assigned that section of Germany as a supreme commander. And he was known to be the best hunter of SS people in the entire U.S. Army. He was in the Army then. And he took a castle, took a mistress, acquired a Mercedes-Benz car, and started collecting these SS Aryan types and putting them in the sub-basement of the castle and doing all kinds of weird sex experiments with them. Now, there was a very specific terminology involved with this, which I've since forgotten. It was not intended as out-and-out, at least so far as I know. It was not intended to be just out-and-out homosexual activity.
Well, was this after the war?
No, it was during the war.
During the war. I thought he was Jewish, though.
Yes, he is Jewish.
Huh.
He was the hunter of the SS. He was the prime hunter for SS agents and SS people. He was known as throughout the Army at the time. He did better at it than anyone else.
Through the U.S.? Was he part of the U.S. Army?
Was he what?
Was he part of the U.S. Army?
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
And certain types of experiments went on there, and after 11 and a half months, I remember the figure because it was such a strange number,
mm-hmm.
11 and a half months, he was relieved of his command there and replaced. And his history then became obscure for a while when he came back to the U.S., and he was approached by some people and saying, we have big things in mind for you. You should go to the university and should get yourself a Ph.D. He says, me? I don't want to go to the university, get a Ph.D. He says, you will go to the university, and you will get a Ph.D., and we'll cover you for it.
Mm.
Who this group was, I don't know. It was in the document I read. And, of course, he did get a Ph.D.
Again, this document, was this one that you read at Los Alamos?
No. No, this is something I read long after.
Okay.
And he did get his Ph.D., and, of course, his rise through politics has been meteoric.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very well known by many, many groups. We don't need to go into his history now. But
sure.
He came from obscurity after he took his Ph.D., I believe in law, because that's what they usually do. But I can't swear to that now. After that, of course, he got heavily involved in politics, and we don't need to go into the political life of Henry Kissinger from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
But his early history was very obscure, and I just happened to trip across a document that explained it, and it explained what I was sensing in the castle, because of what he was doing during the tail end of World War II. I was there in 1960. Let's see, was it...
this is a castle in Mannheim.
60.
Castle in Mannheim, Germany, right?
Yeah, there is a name for the castle. I've forgotten what it is. It's still there, so far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly in 1960.
Hmm.
And since.
Okay.
So
and
back one since.
So Henry Kissinger was one of the three people that voted you out.
Yes.
I see.
Two out of three voted me out. The man who wanted to get rid of me and Mr. Kissinger, Vannevar Bush, would not. But I think we should leave reference to the latter two off. It's all right to talk about Teller wanted me out,
mm-hmm.
and it was arranged for me to be removed.
Okay, I can edit this here.
And then, of course, I was on July 4th. Was at a picnic, it was a holiday, with my family, my wife and Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
In a little town adjacent to Los Alamos. And up drives a Navy bus, some MPs get out, and they look at me and ask for formal identification. You are Captain Edward Cameron? That is correct. You're under arrest. I said, huh? Mm-hmm. I said, I'm sorry, you're under arrest. I said, and what is the charge? I said, espionage. I said, this is ridiculous. I said, I'm sorry, we have orders to bring you in. So they handcuffed me, and it's a tearful goodbye to my wife and son. It was the last I saw them for years. I did see them once in 1952 after that, while I was still at Cameron. that's a little later story.
So what year was this that you were arrested?
1947, okay. July 4th.
Wow.
So I was down to the bus to the train across country to Washington, D.C., expected a full court-martial.
Mm-hmm.
All charges were dropped, and the Navy said, we have another assignment for you. Hmm. And the charges were dropped. I said, now what the hell is this? And I was told not to ask too many questions, but I was given another assignment. It was to go out and work, or not work on, but be an observer to what was known as the Mach 1 project at that time, at Edwards, what is now Edwards Air Force Base, was Muroc Dry Lake test bed in early 47.
Seems like, you know, most fathers, I mean, you had a family, you had a wife. I mean, most fathers would have protested and said, not no, but hell no. I'm not going to do this. You're not going to take
it. My father never did anything about this.
No, you.
Oh, yeah, I did. I screamed bloody murder.
Right, but how did they get you to cooperate?
I can't even answer that one at this time, except there was perhaps some kind of mind manipulation, mind control, because that had been already applied more than once in my career.
Mm.
Not shortly after I got in the Navy, but in the period around early 1940.
That would be the only thing that would explain that.
I'm sorry?
That would be the only thing that would explain that.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah.
No, I didn't jump up and down the way I should have.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was moved to down there to what is now Edwards as an official observer, and as I found out with a lot of research since in the last year, which I didn't have access to all the records, but somebody else did, there were 12 official observers on that project down there, 10 U.S., and two foreign ones, one Italian and one German. I think my phone is about to beep at me.
This is the Mach 1 project,
yes.
Right?
That was the one where Bell was involved with the XS-1 mm-hmm. to get it to fly faster than the speed of sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I was an observer on that. I met the crew. I met Chuck Yeager. I met Jack Ridley, who was the chief aeronautical engineer, and he and I became associated in a project later.
Mm-hmm.
And the test was fully successful on the 28th of October, 1947, which they got Mach 1.05. Primarily because of Ridley. He had not only the background of engineering, he had a rather incredible insight. But he had a bachelor's degree in physics and a master's in aeronautical engineering out of Caltech. And he got his Caltech degree while in the Army. He joined the Army. They transferred him to the Army Air Force. Eventually, of course, when the Air Force became a separate entity, he was in that.
Right. So you were still... I guess, ripped away from everybody that you knew at that time.
That's right. I was ripped away from everybody that knew me.
Even Duncan?
That's right. Duncan, of course, was long gone. That's because of what happened in the Philadelphia experiment.
That's correct. We'll get into that later.
Right.
Okay. But you're still Ed Cameron at this time.
That's right.
Okay. Just to set the record straight.
Now, the test was concluded. And, of course, the Navy at that time started, from what I've read of the book on the subject, a project of their own. I was not part of it. The Air Force continued, of course, with additional work and projects. But the observers more or less scattered. But I stayed behind for a period of time there because the Navy didn't know still exactly what to do with me, and that was a good project to hide me on and to... keep me busy doing something which was of value to the Navy, namely reporting the progress of this thing, the various phases, and of course because of that and perhaps other Navy reports, because there were a whole bevy of observers, decided to start a project of their own.
Let's go back a little bit, and this brings up a question for me.
Okay.
And that is, you know, you commented earlier that the way we won World War II
yes.
was our ability to time travel and bring back technology.
Right.
Why in the world would we even bother this time, many years ahead, to even worry about trying to invent some technology that got us to Mach 1 when we had the capability at that time to do it ourselves just by going into the future and getting it?
Well, this was in the period of 1943, 44, 45.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans had a rocket engine craft ready to go into production. They held it up from 41 to 40, late 44, early 45. ME-263, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
correct.
And they had other craft, and even all of their own facilities being bombed to oblivion on the surface, they still had everything functioning underground, all the underground factories and such. It was common knowledge in the high command, and Winnie Churchill was quoted later on this as having said it. He says, if we don't beat the Germans by the summer of 1945, they will win the war hands down. Now, this is where Germany already blasted the smithereens on mm-hmm. the surface.
Mm-hmm.
They were building the V-2 rockets and launching them against against England. They were working on a nuclear warhead. They already had a nuclear bomb nearly ready to go. They had a nuclear bomb. That is an atomic bomb, but they never used it. They were looking for a new type that they could put on a four-engined supersonic jet bomber, which was to be built in July 45 to bomb New York. And literally level New York.
Right.
They never got to do it because the incredible amount of effort was expended to knock Germany out of the war. And we helped the Russians. We gave them incredible quantities of military hardware. They would have lost it if it hadn't been for us. And Stalin acknowledged this after the war was over.
Okay, well, I may be a little fuzzy on my dates, but did you leave Los Alamos after the bombing at Hiroshima? Or before.
I remained in Los Alamos until 47. The bomb was dropped on Hiroshima in July, sometime in July 45, and then Nagasaki a week later.
Right.
And then the war ended, and they were, for a while we're not sure whether they would retain the labs or abandon them. Of course, they did retain them.
Oh, yeah.
But the directorship wanted them to go. It was then taken over, in essence, by University of California to run the labs
mm-hmm.
sometime around 47. And Oppenheimer, who was the director, remained on until he was removed by Louis Strauss of the AEC, which was formed after the war was over.
Is Oppenheimer the name of the person you were trying to remember
yes.
earlier?
Yeah, J. Robert Oppenheimer.
Okay. And you knew him personally?
Yes, quite well.
Well, how would you characterize him?
I would characterize him as scientifically very astute. He had a great deal of insight, and he was accused of having communist connections.
Right.
So far as I know, personally, at that time, he never did anything to aid the Russians during the war.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, however, was another matter. Mm. His wife was apparently an outright member of the Communist Party, and that was one of the problems that came down on his head because of his wife. And the war was over. He was accused, and I do not know if it was a fact, but he was accused of getting large amounts of processed uranium out of Canada to Russia to help them with their bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know if that's a fact or not. That was the accusation made at his trial. And, of course, Louis Strauss was out to get him to remove him and destroy his first his clearance his pole, and they tried to get him in prison. They couldn't do it, but they broke him in terms of his prestige and his appearance before the scientific fraternity.
Right. Now, what do you think the real reason was for them wanting you out of Los Alamos The real reason for them wanting you to get out of Los Alamos and completely losing your identity, it had to be more than just a simple argument with Teller.
Oh, very true.
What do you think it was?
I know what it was. The other half of that, shall we say, the other side of the coin, the other half of the problem, was that on July 3rd, July 4th or 5th,
mm-hmm.
there was a famous crash of a UFO at Roswell on the Braswell Ranch. Actually, two came down, one at Braswell's ranch, one much further north. And the scientific team, when the word got out to Washington, the scientific team was sent in to evaluate this thing. That scientific team included Dr. John von Neumann,
mm-hmm.
Vannevar Bush, one of the scientists from Harvard, and a whole team of group, about seven scientists, headed up by Vannevar Bush. And I know very well that von Neumann would have asked to have me on that team of observers. And there was no way the Navy was going to allow me to get mixed up with that.
Why?
We have to go back to the Philadelphia experiment, what happened to the Philadelphia experiment.
Okay, which we'll get into later, but just briefly, why do you think that would be?
We very briefly because the Philadelphia Experiment, when it was the ship, the Eldridge, was in hyperspace, had aliens on the deck. They implanted several of the sailors who were roaming around on the deck at that time. I was not there when it happened because I jumped overboard. But that turned up later in the documents I have showing the implants of one of the sailors uncovered by the chief MD, Dr. Oscar C. Schneider. Oscar Schneider, whose son, Phil Schneider, I knew.
So what would the concern be if you had...
The concern would be that I would be running into some more aliens and there might be some further connection. And they just didn't want me mixing it up with any more aliens. They knew damn well there were aliens there. And, of course, they recovered one live and was a guest of the government for 2.5 years afterwards. The whole story is in Victor J. Corso's book, The Day After Roswell. He broke all of his security clearances to both lecture in July 1997 when I was there at Roswell for the 50th anniversary, as well as the release of his book. They did not want me connected in any way.
Because they just didn't want to take any chances, is
right.
what you're saying.
They didn't want to take any chances. Von Neumann, of course, did meet one of these aliens, and it was because of that that he was able to solve the problems of the Philadelphia Experiment, in my view. I cannot document that. But I would say that is my view because the aliens knew what the problem was. They knew much more about time and the variables involved than we did at that time. And these guests usually talked. The one that was left alive apparently was friendly. And most of them knew the Earth language, the principal language, which was English. I'm sure they've been monitoring our TV and radio for years. In any case...
And they still decided to come here.
It was after that that Von Neumann went back and was asked by the Navy to... Look, and that was in 1947, to go back and see, re-examine the Philadelphia Experiment, see if you can find out what went wrong, and if there's any possible answers and how you could correct the situation. Well, he did find the answers, and eventually by 1953 had a whole new working system, which involved, of course, developing the modern electronic digital computer, which we, of course, used tubes at that time. Solid-state devices were just beginning to come in very secretly in 1947-49. And he developed a new system involving a computer, which was installed and bought a Navy carrier, the USS Midway. And tests were performed in the summer of 53, which were fully successful, no side effects, and no other problems. And, of course, from that design, it's gone on forward through many generations of redesign to the systems that we have today, which are much smaller. They're very low power. They don't produce side effects like they did on the original test, because it was just too cotton-picking much power.
Yeah, yeah.
They were running megawatts of power, and the approach they used at that time, they needed it to make it work.
Okay, that's again...
The approach was archaic, and...
But that's usually where things start out,
sure,
though.
Sure, they start someplace.
And then they just
get... And they refine it afterwards.
Look at the computer today.
Yes,
certainly
exactly.
No resemblance to what it was.
If you look at the picture, which I have in my files, of the original computer, which Von Neumann built, which is now in the... actually in storage in the archives of the Smithsonian. I mean, you look at this hunk of, you would practically call it a piece of junk, and say, that is a computer?
But that was the starting point.
That was the start. It
right,
worked.
Right.
It proved the principles.
So
that was what was important.
So here we are, year 2000, no telling what they have now.
Yeah, there's no telling where we're going the next 50 years.
It'll be an interesting ride. But let's go back to, I believe we were at Edwards Air Force Base, where you were working... With the Mach 1 project?
Yes.
I think that's where we left it, and we vectored out a few other places.
Right.
So you were there for a while.
Yes.
You oversaw, or you were participating in some of the experiments.
I wasn't doing more than observing and writing my reports, of course.
Okay.
Insisted on reports.
But now, what I understand, I've heard some reports that that alien craft that you're talking about that crashed in Roswell actually went to Edwards Air Force Base. Any knowledge of that?
It went to Holloman, which was in New Mexico, first, and then that's where the public record has now come out for those who have talked. It went to Holloman. From Holloman, it went to the major research base, which is in Ohio.
That's Edwards. Isn't Edwards in Ohio, right?
Not Edwards, no.
I'm sorry.
It's Edwards is in California.
Right, right, okay.
I'll remember the name after a while.
Okay, but now it's making sense.
Anyway, they went there, and the bodies went there, and perhaps one of the live one may or may not have gone there. That I don't know. But it went from Holloman to the Wright-Patterson
Ohio. That's what I'm looking for, okay.
And so did many others afterwards. They had another crash in 48 at White Sands. They had another crash in New Mexico, not near the Braswell Ranch, but someplace in New Mexico in 49. And from those series of crashes, they began to see a pattern that the Air Force had a brand new radar system, which was operating around 435, 440 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was brand new for them. The Navy already had much better radar. The Navy radars, which were installed during a period from 42, 43 on, all contained a magnetron operating at roughly 9.5 gigahertz,
mm-hmm.
gave them excellent PPI plan position indicator scope readings, which gave them very good images, have excellent range.
You think
the Air Force didn't catch up for quite a while.
You think those were bringing down the alien craft?
They did. Not the ones with the magnetrons, which are running up around 9.5 gigs, but the earlier versions, which were using push-pull triodes and all kinds of other configurations,
mm-hmm.
operating in the vicinity of 430 to 450 megahertz, it was
mm-hmm.
found out later that that's a very critical frequency. 435 megs specifically is a very critical frequency involving the physical universe and manipulations of the universe. This was later used at Montauk,
mm-hmm.
but what it did was it interfered with the functionings of the navigational computers on board the alien craft, so they went totally out of control, and they couldn't control the craft, and they crashed.
Mm.
This happened enough that finally they began to realize this, and then they started going after them with the radars to bring down as many as they could.
Is that why the aliens try to come up with some treaty with us?
That's correct, from 1954. At Edwards.
Was it Edwards or Wright-Patterson?
Came down, and the president was invited to come see them
mm-hmm.
by the military, who were there first, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the president, Eisenhower, showed up, and he wasn't allowed to get close to the craft, close enough to see them. But the military finally told him, he says, look, so these guys have been here 2 weeks. There's nothing we can do to open these craft up, break them down, cut them up, or to get in them in any way, size, shape, or form. We haven't the foggiest notion of what makes them run. He says, their technology is so far beyond us, we don't even know where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
He says, make a treaty with these guys. We don't care what kind of a treaty, just make a treaty. We got to buy time to find out what to do. Of course, they already had crashed ones they weren't telling the president about.
So this is the first time he ever knew that there were crashed aliens?
I'm sorry?
Was this the first time he ever knew? This was Eisenhower, right?
Possibly it was. I cannot say that with certainty. But
Truman must have known about Roswell.
About him, yes.
Yeah.
But Eisenhower was a military man, was over in Europe. Now, unless he read some of the older newspapers,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think he knew German, Europe was plagued with overflights of UFOs and aliens
right.
on the ground from 1940, late 41 into 43.
Mm-hmm.
I got this from a person who I talked with in Tucson, Arizona years ago, who had been one of the German girls who was imprisoned in the concentration camp because she wouldn't show up for the morning exercises, as was ordered. But she read the paper. She knew all about the UFO problem all over Europe. So they would come down at night, and they were sweeping the streets of people, animals, anything they could, even garbage cans. So there was a curfew placed on the entire population, dusk to dawn, in Germany, France, Holland, and Belgium.
What year was this?
It started in 42 and went through to late 43. So when the war got really hot and all of it suddenly seemed to disappear under the rug, it wasn't reported anymore, and suddenly nobody seemed to be seeing any of these aliens anymore. I guess they didn't want to get involved in the middle of the war. But it's prior to the fact that the war got very hot and very heavy,
mm-hmm.
they were all over Europe. They said most people never heard of this.
Well, yeah, why is it that I have never once heard about that?
Well, I will defy you to find anybody in MUFON that ever heard about it.
It's never come across my radar screen.
Nope.
Not once.
Well, it only came across mine because she told me about it, and she showed me the headline. She'd saved the papers.
Wow.
They're German, of course.
Well, let's go back. We're going to try to finish up on the story of Ed Cameron.
Okay, well.
Let's take it from where we left off, and we'll finish it up, because we're coming to the close of this.
Yeah, we're running almost 2 hours now.
Yeah.
When the Mach 1 project was over, I got to know Ed Ridley quite well. Jack Ridley, I'm sorry. And we thought about this and said, well, if we're going to do any space exploration, said rockets are fine. They produce lots of power for a short period of time, but they're no good for long-range research or long-range programs. So we both came up with a knowledge of physics, the idea of maybe an ion propulsion system would work.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back to our various commanding chiefs and sections, the Air Force, myself to the Navy, and put up this proposal. I'd like to work together with Ridley and Ridley to his people on developing an ion propulsion engine. Well, there wasn't none then.
Would you be a civilian at that time?
No, we were still both still in the service.
Okay.
And they liked the idea, and they said, okay, go find a facility. They gave us both executive leave. We'll finance it, build up a facility. So because he had prior connections with the aircraft companies in California, we only found that out even more recently, he apparently decided the idea would be appropriate to build a facility in California near Los Angeles, and we chose the Malibu Canyon. So the facility was built there, and to make a long story short, after a lot of failures and tests, in January of 1953, we had a fully successful test of an ion propulsion engine.
How were you funded for this development?
I'm sorry?
How were you actually funded?
Funded by the military.
Hmm.
By the Navy and the Air Force both. Now, when we had the successful test, my father got into the act, and he had heard about it. He was, of course, connected with intelligence. I didn't know that at the time. And he says, well, if you're prepared to incorporate and file a patent, he says, I can provide you with unlimited funding to get this thing off the ground.
Your father said this?
Yes. You remember his visit?
Mm-hmm.
This was in February, if I remember right, of 53.
So he just pops in and pops out all the time, doesn't he?
Oh, he did that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. And he asked me, he says, how much do you think it would take to carry this project forward into a possible production? I says, Father, I have no idea. Well, take a guess. I said, okay, $200 to $300 million. And he looked at me and says, if you get this thing off the ground, it's going to take at least $1 billion and probably much more. And as I repeat, I have unlimited funding available. I didn't know at that time it was connection to certain European trust funds. Only found that out much, much later. Any case, we incorporated and started to file for patents. Jack went out on a business trip.
How were you able to incorporate a new business if you were actually still in the military?
Well, the business as such wasn't. We were. The staff was not.
Okay.
We had people working for us. And we were on executive leave, and very few people knew about our military connection.
So you were acting as a civilian at that point?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
It was a repeat in a certain sense of what Father was doing.
Yeah.
In any case, while he was on his business trip, in one day comes a team of black ops specialists, and these black ops characters, and grab me and take me out in front of everybody, and off to Washington we go.
This is while you're at the office?
Hmm?
Were you at the office at this time?
Yes, I was at the office.
Now, so this was right after the meeting with your dad then?
Shortly after.
Mm-hmm.
We also knew that another company was sniffing around to try and get in on this thing. And we were able to resurrect that information in part. That other company was known as Cristaldi Research Group.
Mm-hmm.
They are known. They are on the computers. Their name is known around if you know where to look.
I have heard that name before.
Yeah, well, they operate out of the, believe it or not, the Vatican.
Yes, okay. And they were interested in this technology.
Right. They're interested in advanced technology.
Okay, so
and they have unlimited money available to them also.
So it sounds like that, there was one faction that was really supporting you.
Yes, and there was another who wanted to take it over.
Right.
Now, in the background of that, before I disappeared, we got a response from Douglas Aircraft. Now, this is a classified project, but they heard all about it. Douglas mm-hmm. Aircraft was ecstatic. They wanted to work with us. The Martin Aircraft in the East Coast was a rather gruff, no comment type of thing. Boeing hit the ceiling. They were up in arms. We figured they had one of the skunk works, and we beat them to it. We never did find out if that was a fact, but that was our suspicion at the time.
Seems like Lockheed would be most interested in this.
Yes, one would think so. I don't remember we ever heard any directly from Lockheed. See, Martin Lockheed became joined later. Martin Aircraft was a fairly small company in the East Coast in the 40s, and by merger and such, of course, they became Martin Lockheed. Many mergers came along
now,
in the years after that.
Now, your partner was Jack Ridley, right?
Ridley, yes.
Ridley, I'm sorry.
R-I-D-L-E-Y.
Whatever became of him?
Well, after I was taken out, given the complete treatment, and taken back to the Pentagon, he stayed on at mm-hmm. the company. Mm-hmm. I was not allowed to go back, and couldn't meet my family. I did sneak one visit with my family in 52 before we had the test in 53, and I don't recall now how I did it, but I did manage to bypass the Navy and get to find out where they were and see them. They were probably still in New Mexico.
Wow.
But in any case, Ridley remained on. He tried to keep the company going. He thought I'd walked out. He didn't know what had happened. Apparently, the office staff had been threatened into silence because they didn't tell him anything.
How big was his staff at the time?
I'm sorry?
How big was his staff?
About 10 people. It was quite small. It was about to expand, but he tried to keep it going, and then in sometime in 1954, he was booted out of the company by some kind of manipulation. Cristaldi took it over, and everything was shut down. I can say Cristaldi took it over because of what happened. It's turned up on the computer run since that JRC Enterprises, which was our company name, does still exist today as a wholly owned subsidiary of Cristaldi Research Group. It's on the computers, if you know where to look. A friend of mine found it.
What computers?
Talking
about the records?
Going through the net, and you have to access government computer files.
Okay.
Which you probably can't do.
Well, so basically, you're saying this whole thing, after you were removed by these black ops people,
the
whole thing essentially fizzled out, and
it fell apart.
And Jack, I'm assuming, really didn't have much of a career
by that
after
point,
that.
I believe he was out of the service. I don't know when
mm-hmm.
he left,
mm-hmm.
but he moved to Florida in 1956,
mm-hmm.
or at least he moved to Florida in 1956. To be more accurate, he formed his own company known as Ridley Aeronautical Machines. In 1957, he flew to Japan for the 10-year reunion of the Mach 1 group and crashed his plane. And the public record says he died as a result of that. I have other information that, like Tesla, he didn't. He remained alive quite a few years after that. He was nursed back to health. He was severely injured.
Yeah, the mystery continues.
And, of course, me, I was returned to the Pentagon.
Right, let's take it up there. So they removed you by force.
Yes, to the Pentagon.
How did they get you to the Pentagon?
By train.
Was this one of these underground trains that you...
I don't believe so, as I remember everything was on the surface at that point because they hadn't started the underground train project yet.
Okay.
That only started in 59.
Okay, so are we in 47?
54.
Okay.
Factually, 50. This was 53.
53 that this happened. Okay.
Yeah. And Ridley was out in 54, so I was brought back to the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're on a train. Do you remember much about that train ride at all?
It was boring as hell.
I would imagine. Were you?
I was under constant guard.
All right.
Had to get permission to go to the bathroom, and then accompanied essentially to the door. And so on. But
couldn't talk to anybody? You couldn't talk to anybody?
No, couldn't talk with anybody outside of that group.
So they were just completely quiet the whole time?
Yep.
Hmm.
I could hardly even talk with them. They were very, very gruff.
And you're probably wondering, you know, what the
hell is going on?
What the hell is going on? And I'm sure you said that, and they just probably didn't even acknowledge that you said it.
Shrugged their shoulders and said nothing.
Okay.
So I get back to the Pentagon, and I transferred to the CIA at Langley, and then
mm-hmm.
from there I transferred to a CIA NSA facility in McLean, Virginia. That's when the fun really began.
But still at this point, you had no idea why you were taken out.
No. No. My first question I asked is, why was I taken out of this operation? I didn't get an answer. That was immediately transferred to the CIA and then in the CIA NSA facility.
But, and this is an operation that they funded. They approved.
That's right.
So you must have been really shocked at that time.
Of course, because the problem is, while the military run many of their own operations, as I found out, they do everything. This is one of the strange problems involved.
Could you say that again? That kind of beeped out.
I say, even though the military essentially runs most of their own operations, run everything, there are certain things, as I found out, they are dictated to them. Hey, that's what I found out in the last ultimate point before I was converted to albilic.
You know, it's funny, is you're still beeping out a lot.
I'm sorry?
You're beeping out. Do you think your cell phone is... or
beeping was an incoming, which I ignored.
Oh, okay. I got it.
So what happened then was, as I say, I went to this McLean, Virginia facility, and I was by the same black ops group. I was literally... I found out there was an operating portal of some kind there. I was kicked into it, and I wound up in Alpha Centauri 1.
Okay, now this this is probably a good place to drop this conversation now.
I'm sorry?
Well, this is probably a good place to end, because that is a whole story unto itself.
Yep.
That, you know, so let's just go right up to the point. You went to the Pentagon.
Yep.
I'm sure you had some conversations, and...
I wasn't given time to have much conversations then. After I got back, I had all the time in the world to talk with them between March and August of 53.
Okay, now, but didn't you, didn't someone say, listen, I don't like what they're going to do with you, but I don't have any choice?
That was von Neumann before I was given the treatment at Montauk. That came later.
Okay, that's later. So at this point, you really didn't know what was going on?
No.
So you just were taken there and then... And then that was the end of it.
That was it. I wound up at Alpha Centauri 1 and interrogated by this strange group of human-looking aliens.
And where exactly is Alpha Centauri 1?
Well, I'm not an astronomer. Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, it's one of the star systems. It's approximately 25 or 26 light years from here. It's not... I'm not even sure if it's in the Milky Way or not. I don't know.
So somehow, and you probably don't know how, you were actually transported?
Yeah, it was a dedicated portal.
Was this in the Pentagon?
No, this was in a CIA-NSA facility. It was a joint facility. I've had to verify that the facility does exist at McLean, and I've even had it tentatively verified by somebody who says, quote, they've heard of that portal, but nobody ever comes back.
Okay, and you're still Ed Cameron at this point.
That's right, I'm still Ed Cameron.
So you went there, and then boom, you're in Alpha Centurion.
Right.
You're being interrogated by those people?
By the Centurions, if you will.
Okay, what do they look like? Describe them for us.
As best as I can remember, they ran slightly under 6 foot.
Mm-hmm.
They were burly. They had a humanoid body. I mean, two arms, two legs, fingers. Wore strange clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Their head was bound up in some kind of a strange wrapping like an apparatus. They had two eyes. They looked like human eyes. They spoke perfect English.
Wow. Well, that's something, Al, we'll get into that next.